A few years ago, when my oldest child, CJ, who you may have seen sitting down here in our new playground, he was in the red shirt, when he was still a little baby, I had a week similar in many ways to this one. CJ had been sick, which meant I was sleep-deprived and grumpy. Hard things were happening in the world. Leaders were making decisions I couldn't support, and everything felt loaded and dire and very important. Feeling overwhelmed by everything, I had taken a news fast for a few days, that is, choosing not to watch or listen to or read the news in any form. So when I decided to finally break my news fast and catch up on the happenings of the world, you can imagine my surprise when the very first story I stumbled upon was a happy one. It was an Associated Press story about a non-denominational school north of Seattle called the Bellingham Christian School. The news was that they had decided to cancel classes that day, but not because of a catastrophe, not because of a scandal or a mass shooting or a problem or any kind of wrongdoing. They had decided to give the kids a day off because the weather was pretty. Here is some of the story. In a sun-deprived part of Washington State, the promise of nice spring weather prompted a small private school to give students a day off to enjoy the sunshine. Principal Bob Sampson said he wanted to give students some time to re-energize and enjoy the weather, adding that he wanted to create the excitement snow days got among the kids. He said, "In a world that's got a lot of hard things going on, it's fun to create a moment of joy." As we prayed about just a few minutes ago, there are certainly a lot of hard things going on in our world. And yet, the sunshine, the cooler nights and refreshing breezes, the smells of autumn flowers blooming all around the neighborhood, the beginning of Halloween decorations starting to appear on people's stoops, the curiosity and laughter of children, the very fact that life goes on during and even after tragedy and pain and suffering, all of these things beckon us to come out, even if just for a while, from under the weight of it all. They beckon us the same way the children beckoned the monk in our reading to come out of himself and into the joy that only fun and silliness and play can offer. They beckon us the same way the floating of bubbles and fireflies draws us into bemused wonder. They beckon us the same way our favorite song or painting, play or movie can draw us outside of ourselves until somehow we lose or forget about our anger, we lose our worries, and in a way we lose ourselves in the fun of it. The reality and the seriousness of life is inescapable, but play of all sorts gives our hearts and spirits space and rest, levity and liberty. Play reminds us that there's a dimension to the human experience that extends beyond the crush of deadlines and competition, out ahead of strife and injustice, and even the laws of physics. Play reminds us of the power of our imaginations. I have always loved the Christmas movie Miracle on 34th Street. Not the new monstrosity, the original black and white one from 1947 with Natalie Wood and Maureen O'Hara, am I right? In it, the main character, Kris Kringle, describes the imagination with these words. "Now you've heard of the French nation or the British nation. Well, this is the imagination. It's a wonderful place. How would you like to be able to make snowballs in the summertime or drive a great big bus right down Fifth Avenue? How would you like to have a ship all to yourself that makes daily trips to China? How would you like to be the Statue of Liberty in the morning and in the afternoon fly south with a flock of geese? It's fairly simple. Of course, it takes practice. Now, in this scene, he's talking to a little girl whose playful and imaginative instincts have been discouraged by her mother for reasons I won't share here in case you haven't seen the movie. I will also prescribe to you as your minister the need to see this movie. But I think for most children, entering the imagination and pretending come pretty naturally. I know my kids spend a lot of their time at home pretending, and I play with them sometimes. Often they will play at this little toy kitchen that we have that has little lights you can turn on for the burners and things like that while I'm in the real kitchen cooking dinner. They will start pretend cooking things that they like because I may be cooking things that they don't like. I think it's their effort to get me to change course and make what they want. It never works. Now, I can't remember the last time I pretended by myself or for myself, but I certainly use my imagination on a regular basis. I don't imagine having a ship that takes daily trips to China, but I often imagine what it would be like to win the lottery. What our world would be like if all the mothers in it put our collective foot down on violence and war. What our country would be like with a healthcare system that values the health of our neighbors more than the profits of a few. Sometimes, and this is out there, I even try to imagine what it might be like to come home and discover that someone else has cleaned the bathroom. Whether about little things or big things, imagination is simply the ability to envision new possible realities for ourselves, new possible realities for our world. But as Kris Kringle admits, it takes practice. It's funny that it can take so much work to make time for play, to make time for the thing that's supposed to be free of work. In between the demands of earning a living and cleaning the house, paying our bills, raising the children, going to the doctor, going to the DMV, it can feel daunting to have to work at making time for the thing that, again, is supposed to be free of work. And yet, once we get to paint night or the kickball game, we get to our vacation, all of the work it took to plan how to get there and prepare things at home or work for our absence, it usually feels worth it. It's like once we've put in the work of learning to read music and learn how to play an instrument, actually making music becomes pure joy. I think the same is true for play. I imagine this is why Plato so famously wrote, as Bob said, "You can discover more about a person in an hour of play than in a year of conversation." Dr. Stuart Brown is the founder and president of the Institute for Play near Monterey, California. And as you can imagine, he studied play for some time. He's written extensively about the importance of play, that play is the way children learn how to be in their world, how they absorb information and grow in knowledge. He's also the one who first said that the opposite of play is not work, it is depression. It was his work that first convinced me of the link between playfulness and mental and emotional health. And while I would hate for us to begin thinking of play and our imaginations in a clinical way, I think it's helpful for adults, those of us for whom play no longer comes as naturally as it does for our younger friends and neighbors, I think it's helpful for us adults to think about play as something that we need and not just something to indulge in. The thing I didn't know until I had kids is how powerful and important playfulness can be in certain emotionally charged moments. I see some nodding heads. Getting my kids to open up about a touchy subject is always harder if we're not playing a game of cards or drawing together. It's almost like their instinct to play needs to be engaged before more real emotional work can happen. I think adults are often similar. The other way playfulness can be really powerful is when it's used to prevent a tantrum or interrupt a negative emotional pattern. Parents of young children everywhere probably know what I'm talking about. Your kids somehow missed nap time. You've survived long enough to make dinner. You were careful to present the food in the manner that you know your child likes it. And all of a sudden, the child begins whining about having to use the red spoon instead of the green spoon. Breathe. You have two options. You can demand the kid use the darn red spoon, but then you're likely to have a tantrum on your hands. Or you can joke around with them about the red spoon. You don't want to use the red spoon? Oh, does it have chicken pox? Oh, I hate that red spoon too, you know? Red spoons are the worst. And suddenly, your kid is laughing, and thank heaven, starting to actually eat with that red spoon. I've seen the same tactic used by and with adults too. It's partly why we have to do those community building exercises at work, why we have icebreakers before important meetings. I'm pretty sure it's why the tradition of the court jester survived for so long. There's something about being silly, about being playful with one another, that helps ease the tension and allows us to work better together in the long run. There's something about keeping space open for imagining new possibilities that helps keep us interested in playing together in new ways and trying new things. The English word silly actually comes from the Greek word selig, which means blessed. Given the link between the sacred and the silly, I hope we can all find ways to make more room and time for play. For those of us with children in the house, this can be as simple as allowing ourselves to get lost in games with our little ones. But play is for everyone. Let's say that together. Play is for everyone. And whether it's a game of cards, a day trip to the sea, just picking up that instrument we used to love playing but can never seem to find time for anymore, getting ourselves out of the daily grind and into our imaginations is good for us. Mind, body, spirit, it's good for our whole selves. For there are indeed a lot of hard things going on in our world. And it is good to make time for joy, time for playfulness, time to imagine what could be. Amen.